The idea of virgin-born gods was already in the cultural atmosphere, and was self-evidently miraculous and thus proof of God's intervention in history in a way that would confirm the divinity of Jesus, there was ample motive to develop and promote the idea. This would not have hindered the actual success Christianity enjoyed, and there is no evidence it did. Conclusion. Holding says, quote, "What it boils down to is that everything about Jesus as a person was all wrong to get people to believe he was a deity, and there must have been something powerful to overcome all the stigmas," end quote. But I've shown there were no stigmas relevant to the very audience the Christians successfully targeted. To the contrary, everything Holding claims made their mission harder actually made their mission easier, or had no significant impact on its success at all among those who did flock to the faith. What Jesus did while on earth was irrelevant to what he could do for you now that he was exalted to the highest throne in heaven, and it was the heavenly Jesus that was sold to the masses, not a mere carpenter from Galilee. Chapter 3. Was resurrection deemed impossible? The popularity of resurrection. James Holding's next argument is that pagans would not buy a physical resurrection of the flesh. Indeed, he says, among the pagans, resurrection was deemed impossible. Of course, this would be no problem for the mission to the Jews, since a great many Jews, though not all of them, already expected such a thing. But it's false anyway. Many pagans believed resurrection was possible, even desirable, and those were probably the very pagans the Christians converted. Already the Jews appear to have gotten the idea of a resurrection of the flesh from pagans. It was a fundamental Zoroastrian belief, and throughout the Roman period Zoroastrianism was the common national religion in the Persian Empire, in practical terms everything east of the Roman Empire up to about India. Theopompus and Eudemus of Rhodes, both Greek historians of the 4th century BC, described this Persian belief. Theopompus wrote in particular that, according to the Persian Magi, men will be resurrected and become immortal, and what then exists will endure through their incantations. So the idea of a physical resurrection would be readily accepted by enough Jews and Persians to present no difficulty for the Christian message. That the Jews borrowed the idea of resurrection from Zoroastrian pagans is demonstrated not only by the fact that early Greek sources identify it as a Persian and not a Jewish belief, but by the fact that the Old Testament completely lacks any reference to the idea until after the Jews were exiled to cities in contact with Zoroastrianism. For example, the earliest mention of it comes from the author of Ezekiel 37, who came up with the idea only late in his career, after 12 years of captivity in Babylon. See Ezekiel 33, verse 21. Daniel mentions it, too, yet again, this book was written about events in Persia and among Zoroastrian magi, and is a 2nd century BC forgery anyway. Likewise, the reference in Isaiah 26 verse 19 appears in a section that modern scholars agree was heavily redacted in the post-exilic period. So clearly a lot of pagans were so completely okay with the idea that they even convinced the Jews of it. Even many Greco-Roman pagans flirted with the possibility of being raised from the dead. We have so many stories and claims of physical resurrection within the pagan tradition that there can be no doubt the Christian claim would face no more difficulty than these tales in finding pagan believers. Herodotus records the Thracians believed in the physical resurrection of Zalmoxis and formed a religion around it that promised eternal paradise for believers. Later on, certain Italians came to believe in the resurrection of Aristeas of Proconesus. Lucian records that the pagan Antigonus had told him, quote, "I know a man who came to life more than 20 days after his burial, having attended the fellow both before his death and after he came to life," end quote. Celsus, though himself a doubter, attested to a widespread belief in resurrected men among the pagans, rattling off a list of those whom pagans believed rose again. Quote, "Zalmoxis in Scythia, the slave of Pythagoras, and Pythagoras himself in Italy, and Rhampsinitus in Egypt, whom they say played at dice with Demeter in Hades, and returned to the upper world with a golden napkin which he had received from her as a gift, and also Orpheus among the Odrysians, and Protesilaus in Thessaly, and Hercules at Cape Tenaris, and Theseus," end quote. Later on, Celsus adds to this list the aforementioned Aristeas of Proconesus as well as the deified Dioscuri, Asclepius, and Dionysus. Besides the Dioscuri, Pliny the Elder says many gods lived and died on alternating days. And that's not all. We've already discussed the resurrections of Romulus, Osiris, Adonis, and Inanna as well. In Chapter 1, we went over those. And we could add several mortals who were resurrected in Greek myth besides the Dioscuri, such as Eurydice and Alcestis, and in legend Theseus. Eurydice returns from the dead, but due to a flubbed promise is forced back, while Alcestis is returned to life by being either rescued or sent back from Hades, either way for selflessly exchanging her life for that of her husband. Euripides wrote an entire play on the death and resurrection of Alcestis. As for Theseus, the famous Athenian king, was seen by soldiers resurrected and fighting on the side of the Athenians at Marathon. Pausanias even says early Athenian art depicted Theseus, quote, rising from the ground, end quote, at Marathon, only 30 years after the war. So it's plainly false to claim that no pagans would believe in a resurrection of the body, especially for a deified or divine man. Even Hercules, whose resurrection is usually portrayed only as an ascent to heaven, nevertheless ascended in his divine body, after its mortal material was burned away on the pyre. In like fashion, Celsus reports that, quote, a great many Greeks and barbarians claim they have frequently seen, and still see, no mere phantom, but Asclepius himself, end quote. And not only was Asclepius a resurrected and deified mortal, but he was the preeminent resurrector of the dead, which was a prominent reason pagans held him in such esteem. Since Justin Martyr could not deny this, he was prompted to claim that, quote-unquote, the devil must have introduced Asclepius as the raiser of the dead in order to undermine the Christian message in advance. Most famously, before his own resurrection, Asclepius had raised Tyndareus from the dead. Hence, Aristides, a devout follower of Asclepius, simply assumed his pagan audience believed a god might be able to resurrect a dead man. It goes well beyond this. Lucian and Apuleius both report the common belief that resurrecting the dead, quote-unquote, calling moldy corpses to life, as Lucian mockingly put it, was one of the expected powers of a sorcerer, and sorcery was very popular among the majority of pagans. Hence, Apuleius has his fictional sorcerer Zachlas raise Telephron from the dead. But among historical claims, Apuleius relates a medical resurrection performed by Asclepiades. Apollonius of Tyana was also believed to have raised a girl from the dead using a spell. In the 4th century BC, Heraclides of Pontus recorded that through some mysterious art, Empedocles, quote, preserved the body of a lifeless woman without pulse or respiration for 30 days, and then he sent away the dead woman alive, end quote. Proclus reports that Eurynous of Nicopolis was buried before the city by his relatives, but then returned to life following the 15th day of his burial, and lived many more years. And that Rufus of Philippi, a pagan high priest, died and returned to life on the third day, living long enough to tell his amazing story. Pliny the Elder reports that there were numerous such tales believed by many people, even without magic. He says Varro reported on two different occasions seeing a person carried out on a bier to burial who returned home on foot, besides witnessing the apparent resurrection of his own uncle-in-law, Corfidius. Pliny also reports that the sailor Gabienus had his throat cut and almost severed, yet returned from the dead that evening to report on his visit to Hades. Plato records a similar story related by Alcinous about the Pamphylian, who was slain in battle and 10 days later his body was recovered and brought home. Then, at the moment of his funeral, on the 12th day, as he lay upon the pyre, he revived, and after coming to life, he related what he said he'd seen in the world beyond. In a similar story, the Syrian commander Bouplagus rises from the dead on a body-strewn battlefield, despite having been stabbed 12 times, as Roman soldiers were looting the bodies, and then chastised the Romans for looting the dead. The lady Philinion returned to life to visit her lover. The villainous Aridaeus fell to his death but returned to life on the third day, to relate his trip to heaven, and was so transformed by what he learned there that he led a life of impeccable virtue thereafter. Timarchus spent 2 nights and a day in a sacred crypt, during which time he died, visited heaven, and returned. Ultimately, Pliny the Elder says he also knew of cases of persons appearing after burial, but chose not to discuss them because his book was about works of nature, not prodigies. This nevertheless proves such tales were transmitted and believed by many people. Pliny himself doesn't say what he believed, only that these stories weren't the subject of his book. but he still records numerous returns from death, and as we've seen, there are many, many more. There were also legends and stories of people resurrected by magic herbs. There appears to have been a popular belief that the Emperor Nero would or did return from the dead. Several cases of ghosts returning from the grave are also recorded, where the ghost clearly had a physical body. Resurrection was actually a common theme in pagan sacred fiction. Petronius even made fun of that theme by having his hero embark on a pilgrimage to resurrect his impotent penis. And Plutarch mentions a play attended by Vespasian in which a dog played at dying and rising again from the dead. The great abundance of these tales reflects a widespread hope within the pagan community of returning to life, or at the very least refutes any notion that this was always thought to be impossible. The evidence is overwhelming, that one could return to life in the body that died, or in an even better body, was a commonplace belief among a great many pagans and was not deemed impossible, except by a few skeptical elites, such as the Epicureans. What matters here is not what the true events were behind all these stories of resurrected men and women. What matters is that many people clearly believed these were genuine risings from the dead, or that such a thing could and did happen, or was something they could imagine happening. Nor does it matter how much any of these stories resemble that of Jesus, also a demigod, being the divine son of a god. For the relevant underlying concept remains the same, returning to life in a body. Therefore, J.P. Holden cannot maintain there was any significant resistance to the Christian claim among those pagans who actually did convert. To the contrary, Christians would have found a large and ready audience eager to believe just such a thing. Any differences there may have been between the many and varied pagan ideas of resurrection and what the Christians taught, which itself varied according to sect, were all minor points of metaphysical detail, not fundamental barriers to the idea of Jesus returning bodily from the dead. Defending the Zoroastrian connection. This is irrefutable. Nevertheless, Holding tries. For instance, he debates whether the Zoroastrians got the idea of resurrection from the Jews rather than vice versa, even though Zoroastrians were still pagans and their resurrection belief was already known to the Greeks and Romans by the time of Christ. But Holding presents no valid evidence for his case. He claims Daniel was written before the 4th century BC, when in fact, as already noted, all objective scholars now agree it's a forgery produced in the 2nd century BC, which leaves Ezekiel as the first Jew ever to mention the doctrine. But Ezekiel wrote from captivity within Babylon, just read Ezekiel 1, verse 1, where Zoroastrianism was already spreading. Only then did he start writing about resurrection, after 12 years of captivity there. So nowhere ever in the entire Old Testament is the doctrine clearly advocated or mentioned until after the Jews were held in captivity for over 10 years within a culture influenced by Zoroastrian beliefs. That's a remarkable coincidence, unless the Jews got the idea from their pagan captors. That the doctrine was attested in Greek sources as early as the 4th century BC and there identified as Persian, not Jewish, also argues for this conclusion. Nothing argues for the reverse. That the Jews adapted and modified the belief to suit their own ideological preconceptions and cultural needs is irrelevant, because that is how syncretism always works. To be influenced does not mean borrowing an exact copy of someone else's idea, but that the Jews were influenced by Persian beliefs is the most obvious explanation of the facts. Not only did they pick up the notion of resurrection there and mold it to their own faith, but they also picked up the idea of a fiery hell and an eschatological war between good and evil, recast as God and Satan. These are fundamental to Zoroastrianism. The entire religion is founded on them, unlike Judaism, which is not. And these beliefs are described in the very pre-Christian reports from Theopompus that Holding himself cites from Plutarch, and that I cite from Laertius. So it's impossible they could have come to Zoroastrianism from Christianity. Yet these are also absent from the Old Testament prior to the Persian exile. Indeed, even in the early post-exilic text of Job, Satan is still an angel in the service of God, and God alone is the ultimate author of evil. Holding blindly asserts that the Jews would not borrow a religious belief from their captors, but this ignores every precedent. Didn't many Jews, like Philo, borrow religious ideas from their Greek conquerors? As well as the reality of ancient cultural belief systems, what the Persians believed their God would do for them was not seen as a rival religious dogma, but as a power that a supreme god obviously should have, and as a better view of the nature of the universe. This would appear to the Jews like any other improvement in knowledge, no different from what they found in astronomy or zoology, and thus just as adaptable to their own beliefs about God. In exactly the same way, post-exilic Jews adopted astrology from their Chaldean captors, another obvious example of borrowing. Indeed, the Persian eschatological ideas of how their God would set things right in the end fit perfectly with what the Jews needed to restore faith in their own beliefs in the face of utter defeat. And by claiming it was their God who would do this, they could even claim superiority over their captors, as the book of Daniel explicitly aims to do, through prophecies and miracles that, quote-unquote, show up the Persian magi. So much for the general point. Now to correct Holding's specific errors in his attempt to quote experts against me. Placing naive trust in Edwin Yamauchi, he quotes Zoroastrianism expert Robert Zahner out of context as if he denied anything I said. Yet had Holding actually done some genuine research, he would know that what Zahner actually says, which Yamauchi downplays, is that Israel found a kindred monotheistic creed in the religion of the prophet Zoroaster, and, quote, from this religion, too, she learnt teachings concerning the afterlife altogether more congenial to her soul than had been the gloomy prospect offered her by her own tradition, teachings to which she had been a stranger before, end quote. Thus, Zahner supports me, not Holding. Indeed, on the Zoroastrian eschatological notion of a future eternal life, Zahner says there was surely influence. For, quote, the similarities are so great and the historical context so neatly apposite that it would be carrying skepticism altogether too far to refuse to draw the obvious conclusion, end quote. What obvious conclusion? That the idea was derived from Zoroastrianism. Rightly so. It is only after that sentence, and that's on page 57 of Zahner's book that Holding is quoting, that what Holding quotes begins. His quote begins, quote, the case for a Judeo-Christian dependence on Zoroastrianism in its purely eschatological thinking is quite different, end quote. Yet Zahner immediately says that a deathless existence in body and soul at the end of time is affirmed in early texts, hence only apart from this one detail does Zahner call for doubt. In other words, Holding's quote from Zahner refers to other elements of Zoroastrian eschatology. Zahner mentions the peculiar details in Paul and the Book of Revelation in particular. Otherwise, Zahner does not doubt that the general idea of a resurrection into paradise or perdition was a product of influence. To the contrary, Zahner holds resurrection as the exception that is surely an instance of influence, while it's only in regard to particular details like uniting soul and body where independent development is credible. Then, after Holding's quote, Zahner immediately says, the case of rewards and punishments, heaven and hell, however, is very different, for the theory of a direct Zoroastrian influence on post-exilic Judaism does explain the sudden abandonment of the old idea of Sheol and the sudden adoption at precisely the time when the exiled Jews made contact with the Medes and Persians of what was essentially a Zoroastrian teaching concerning the afterlife. In fact, he says, Daniel presents a clear case of Persian influence, and thus, from the moment that the Jews first made contact with the Iranians, they took over the typical Zoroastrian doctrine of an individual afterlife in which rewards are to be enjoyed and punishments endured. And so, too, the idea of a bodily resurrection at the end of time was probably original to Zoroastrianism, however it arose among the Jews. So says Zahner. In other words, Zahner is saying that the Zoroastrians came up with the idea of resurrection first and on their own, while the Jews did not develop any idea of resurrection until after their contact with the Persian religion. Hence, when Zahner expresses doubt whether the Jews borrowed their specific doctrines of resurrection, he does not mean what Holding claims, that the Zoroastrians got the idea from the Jews, but rather that the Jews got the idea after being influenced by the Zoroastrian doctrine of an afterlife, but may have developed their own resurrection doctrine in response to this influence, rather than simply adopting any particular Persian scheme. In other words, Zahner is uncertain whether the Jewish resurrection doctrine as a whole was borrowed from Zoroastrianism, but he is otherwise clear that the idea of resurrection was certainly the product of influence. And he's quite adamant when it comes to our subject. Quote, the resurrection of the body, Zahner says, Christianity inherited from Zoroastrianism, end quote. It's no accident that the only contemporary scholars Holding can find arguing the contrary are Yamauchi and Bremer. They are pretty much the only ones left who maintain any skepticism. And yet Yamauchi does not argue against borrowing, nor for any reverse influence, but merely argues the evidence is not sufficient to convince him, and therefore we should reserve judgment. But Yamauchi engages the dubious tactic of citing outdated and obsolete scholars against current updated scholarship. He also uses selective quoting and special pleading. For example, he simply dismisses late texts without considering any arguments for the antiquity of their contents, an approach that would destroy most of the Bible as well. Ultimately, Yamauchi concedes the very fact I stated in the first place, that the widest consensus of scholarship stands against his own skepticism. Hence, Holding tries to pretend a lone maverick represents the scholarly consensus, and yet even that maverick does not maintain the position Holding wants to maintain himself. That leaves Bremer. Right off the bat, I was suspicious of this guy, since everything Holding quotes him saying is false. Does the whole genre of Iranian apocalypticism post-date Christian times? Theopompus proves the contrary. Is it at least the current consensus of scholars that the contents of all the relevant Zoroastrian texts are themselves post-Christian? No. The widest consensus of scholars has come to the opposite conclusion for the content of at least some Persian texts. Continuing this tendency to misrepresent the facts, Bremer claims, quote, Mary Boyce has consistently presented a static view against all evidence and common sense, end quote. Yet that's completely false. Mary Boyce, a renowned expert in Zoroastrian studies, presents a very nuanced and careful analysis of the historical development of Zoroastrian doctrine over time, taking into account numerous developments and changes. She does not regard all Zoroastrian texts and beliefs to predate later eras. Why would Bremer say the opposite? Did he not really read her work? Or is he playing fast and loose with hyperbole and invective? Last but not least, Bremer claims, quote, Mary Boyce quotes only Aeneas, not Diogenes Laertius, end quote, which is again false. In her three-volume history, Boyce discusses both passages in detail. With three irresponsible misstatements of fact to his credit already, one in almost every quote Holding chose to use, we can dismiss Bremer as unreliable. He even appears to claim that Josephus never attributed the idea of resurrection to the Pharisees, but mentioned only their belief in the immortality of the soul, which of course is not true. Josephus wrote that, quote, the Pharisees say that all souls are incorruptible, but the souls of good men only are transported into other bodies, while the souls of bad men are subject to eternal punishment, end quote. And he says again that bad souls, quote, are to be detained in an everlasting prison, end quote, while good souls, quote, shall have power to revive and live again, end quote. And Josephus was himself a Pharisee and says point blank that he believed in a resurrection of the body at the end of time. It's possible Bremer did not mean to deny exactly this, but either way, Bremer still argues that the Jews did not develop any doctrine of resurrection until the 2nd century BC, which, if true, would kill Holding's case for the contrary. Thus, even if we trust Bremer, his actual argument goes against Holding. So that makes twice that Holding tried to spin what fringe experts say into a support for his case. Yet even they don't actually support him. I can only conclude that Holding must be counting on his readers not actually checking his references. Finally, when Holding tries to play the expert himself, we get a fatal dose of fallacies and lazy research. For example, he argues that Ezekiel speaks of the dead being raised from graves, and yet the Persians exposed their dead, as if that mattered, but it doesn't. The fact is, the Persians collected the bones of those they exposed and interred them in ossuaries or shafts to await resurrection. This is essentially what the Jews did, so there is no relevant difference here after all. In other words, of the differences that there were between Zoroastrian and Jewish burial practices, indeed, even of the differences that developed between Zoroastrian and Jewish resurrection beliefs, none matter for Holding's argument. For even the Zoroastrians had, quote-unquote, places of burial, Ezekiel's Kibrah, to open for the dead to rise. As another example of his specious tactics, Holding selectively quotes Plutarch, leaving out material that undermines his case, and then jumps to conclusions without actually researching them. Holding claims, for example, that Plutarch's quotation of Theopompus in his book on Isis and Osiris gives us a seemingly contradictory description, and Plutarch makes no clear reference to resurrection of the body. But had Holding actually looked at the passage in context, he would have seen that it began like this, quote, a destined time shall come when it is decreed that the author of evil shall be utterly annihilated and shall disappear, And then the earth shall become a level plain, and there shall be one manner of life and one form of government for a blessed people who shall all speak one tongue. But Theopompus says that, according to the Magi, one God is to overpower the other each in turn for the space of 3,000 years. And finally Hades shall pass away. Then shall the people be happy, and they shall neither need food nor cast a shadow. End quote. In other words, Plutarch is not quoting everything Theopompus said, but only what he said that disagreed with what Plutarch had just described. And Plutarch is here only concerned with a disagreement over how the end would come about, whether all at once or after several ages of reversal. Otherwise, Plutarch's description is clear. The future paradise he's talking about will be a life on Earth, two details holding left out, and it will involve the final elimination of death, Hades, and those who enjoy this ultimate paradise will not need to eat. This certainly sounds like a resurrection, an immortal return to earthly life. Even including the peculiar detail that in the future people will cast no shadow, for there is nothing here that contradicts Diogenes Laertius, nor does Plutarch's description allow Holding's inference that only a disembodied afterlife was meant. Nevertheless, to try and bolster his speculation that Theopompus originally described some sort of bodiless future, Holding ignores every detail except the last, claiming that not casting a shadow would not fit with the physical resurrectional existence, though he fails to explain why. Instead, he cites yet another passage that he obviously did not actually check himself, claiming that Plutarch elsewhere says, "Those who cast no shadows are those who have been liberated from the body," as if this meant the only way to cast no shadow is to have no body, already a fallacious inference. But in actual fact, it's not Plutarch who says this, but a Pythagorean ghost in a story Plutarch relates from another source. Hence, this reflects a particular sectarian doctrine and not Plutarch's own assumption, as he makes clear elsewhere, as I'll get to in a moment. Moreover, the ghost in this story says, "The souls of the dead neither cast a shadow nor blink their eyes, although they had form, color, facial features, and otherwise physically displaced the air. Quote, as the souls of those who die came up from below, they made a flame-like bubble as the air was displaced, and then, as the bubble gently burst, came forth in human form." End quote. And they experienced physical torments and pleasures. Hence, these are not bodiless souls, but astral bodies. In other words, bodies made of elements superior to the body of flesh, just as Paul argues we will have when we are resurrected. Look in 1 Corinthians 15 and 2 Corinthians 5. Moreover, all these souls are visible yet luminous. Hence, the reason they cast no shadow cannot be because they are bodiless, for they have form, color, and recognizable features, and are not fully transparent, but because they are radiant, for lights do not cast shadows. Elsewhere, in fact, Plutarch says stars and other lights cast no shadow, and that disembodied souls appear as rays of light, are transparent, and physically composed of ether. In other words, since radiant bodies cast no shadow, we can't assume casting no shadow means a bodiless state, nor can we impose this Pythagorean doctrine of souls onto a description of Persian beliefs by Theopompus. If anything is shared in common between the two, it would sooner be luminosity than the absence of a body. In other words, transformation into a more glorious body, much like what Holding says the Jews believed. And in fact, when we finally look at what Plutarch himself has to say about the idea of casting no shadow, being in a bodiless state is not what he assumes to be the cause. Instead, Plutarch is perplexed by the idea. Quote, "The tale that no shadow is cast by a person who enters the Lyceion, the holy inner sanctum in the temple of Arcadian Zeus, is not true, although it has acquired widespread credence. Is it because the air turns to clouds and lowers darkly upon those who enter? Or is it because he that enters is condemned to death, and the followers of Pythagoras declare that the spirits of the dead cast no shadow, neither do they blink? Or is it because it is the sun which causes shadow, but the law deprives him that enters of the sunlight?" End quote. From this, we learn three things. First, the idea that souls cast no shadows is uniquely Pythagorean and thus not Plutarch's view, nor, as far as we know, the view of Theopompus or his Magi informants. Second, Plutarch didn't know why something would cast no shadow and struggles with several hypotheses, so the phrase did not entail a bodiless state even to him. And third, this is clearly not a case of being bodiless, For this widely believed claim he's talking about was about flesh and blood people, and therefore it was widely believed that a body of flesh and blood could cast no shadow. In fact, it's suggestive that this new property is acquired only in the Holy of Holies, which the god was believed to inhabit. Hence, the Zoroastrians may have believed the whole earth would become holy by God's eternal presence, and thus all darkness would be abolished, shadows and all. Whether that was the cause, or the idea that resurrected bodies would be luminous, we can't say, because Theopompus doesn't tell us. But we can infer one thing. For this tale about the Arcadian sanctum also comes from Theopompus. Polybius reports, quote, "It is a sign of a blunted intelligence to say that some solid bodies, when placed in the light, cast no shadow, as Theopompus does when he tells us that those who enter the Holy of Holies of Zeus in Arcadia become shadowless," end quote. Pausanias gives us more detail about this amazing chamber, this time from his own direct questioning of local Arcadians. There was a popular legend that everything alike within the precinct, whether beast or man, casts no shadow, and when a beast takes refuge in it, a hunter will not rush in after it, but remain outside, and though he sees the beast, he can see no shadow. Here we have it. This story comes from Theopompus, and independently, it comes from Pausanias as well, yet it clearly involved physical bodies of flesh and blood. Therefore, Theopompus clearly did not think casting no shadow meant a bodiless state. So Holding is quite wrong to claim he did. Albert de Jong provides the most thorough discussion of this reference to casting no shadows in Plutarch, and in Greek and Iranian literature generally. De Jong notes that most Zoroastrian scholars have rejected Holding's interpretation, that casting no shadow means a bodiless existence. Instead, some have offered the interpretation that all darkness will simply be abolished, as by God's eternal presence, while others have argued that since Zoroastrian texts have the sun standing still in the middle of the sky in the New World, casting no shadow could simply refer to the condition of things under a noonday sun. De Jong himself observes that in Zoroastrian texts, the horses and chariots of Mithras are described as casting no shadow as well, while other texts say Zarathustra did not see his own shadow on the earth when he approached certain angelic beings because of their great luminosity. From a survey of further evidence, de Jong ultimately concludes that early Zoroastrians believed they would receive a spiritual body at the resurrection and would thus become angelic beings like these. Hence, they would cast no shadow because their bodies would be radiant, thus confirming my point and demonstrating how little Holding cares for doing any actual research. Debating Zalmoxis. J.P. Holding isn't the only Christian apologist who acts like this. On the 27th of October in 2006, on the net radio show The Infidel Guy, with Christian apologists Gary Habermas and Mike Lacona, my claim that Zalmoxis was thought to be resurrected was also challenged. I was told that Zalmoxis taught his followers that he and they would never die, and therefore, it was argued, Zalmoxis never died, and therefore, it was argued, he was never resurrected. This is nonsense. Yet, as is so often the case, once again we have to haul out the grass just to prove it's green. Here is what Herodotus says in the fourth book of his histories, which I have translated directly from the Greek. Quote, "Darius first conquered the Getae, who considered themselves immortal. This is the way they consider themselves immortal. When they are killed, they do not think they die, but that they go to the divine being Zalmoxis, though some of them call this being Gibala Isis. Every 5 years, they send off one of their group chosen by lot as a messenger to Zalmoxis, giving him orders on each occasion regarding what he must do. And this is how they send him. Some of them appointed to the task hold short spears, while others grab the hands and feet of the one who is to be sent off to Zalmoxis, swing him back and forth, and toss him up in the air right onto the spearheads. If he is impaled and dies, they think the god favors them. If he does not die, they blame the very messenger, saying he is a bad man, and once they have laid the blame on him, they send off another. Of course, they give a messenger his orders while he is still alive. These are the same Thracians who also threaten their god by shooting arrows up into the sky at thunder and lightning, and they do not think there is any other god except their own. What I hear from the Greeks who live on the Hellespont and the Pontus is that this Zalmoxis was a man enslaved in Samos, enslaved, in fact, to Pythagoras, son of Nisarchus. Later he was freed and made a great deal of money, and once he had made his money, he went back home. Since the Thracians lead miserable lives and are rather stupid, this Zelmoxis, who had learned that the Ionian culture and lifestyle is deeper than the Thracian, inasmuch as he had lived with Greeks, and not the feeblest of Greeks either, but the philosopher Pythagoras, got himself a banquet hall, and there would invite the most prominent people and entertain them sumptuously, all the while teaching them that neither he, nor those who drank with him, nor any of their descendants would die, but they would come to that place where they would have eternal life and all good things would come to them. While he was doing what I said and teaching these things, he was building an underground dwelling there. As soon as he finished this, he vanished from the Thracians, having gone down into his underground dwelling, and he lived there for 3 years. They missed him and mourned him as dead. Then in the 4th year, he appeared to the Thracians, and because of that, the things Zelmoxis told them became credible. This is what they say he did. But regarding that underground dwelling, I myself neither disbelieve nor believe much at all. In fact, I think this Zelmoxis lived many years before Pythagoras. And whether there was any man called Zelmoxis, or whether this is just some divine being among the Getae, let's put that aside. End quote. There are several points to make here. First, it's clear the argument made on that radio show takes its information on what Zelmoxis taught from hostile Greeks, not the believing Getae, and from a story intended to discredit and ridicule the Getic faith, which Herodotus does not believe and all but refutes. His first paragraph relates what Herodotus knew from the Getae. Then his second paragraph, as Herodotus himself says, does not come from the believers, but from their unbelieving Greek neighbors. Yet according to his own information, Zelmoxis predates Pythagoras, and therefore the entire story he heard from the Greeks is apparently bogus, and therefore cannot reflect what the Getae actually believed or taught. This Greek version of events is exactly comparable to anti-Christian accounts of Jesus, such as making up stories about Mary being impregnated by a Roman soldier or Christ's body being stolen, all to explain away the actual faith claims of the believers. Here, a story is being made up about a trick pulled on those stupid Thracians by an unscrupulous ex-slave in order to explain away the actual resurrection claims of the Getic religion. When it comes to interpreting early Christian beliefs, a Christian would not tolerate any argument that assumed such a slander was true, so he cannot assume it in this case either without being a hypocrite. The bottom line is that what Herodotus heard from the Greeks is clearly not true, nor is it an accurate description of what the Getae believed. Therefore, right from the get-go, the argument made on the radio is based on false and inaccurate information. Second, when Herodotus says the Getae believe they are immortal, he carefully goes on to explain what he means by that, and from his description it should be obvious that he does not mean they thought they can't be killed or would never die in any sense at all. They clearly believe they die. As Herodotus says, when they are killed, then they go to eternal life. They even kill each other to prove it. Their whole religion involves killing a messenger just to go and talk to their god. And clearly they'd all know that their neighbors and kin can and do die in battle, or of disease, old age, and so on. So the claim that these people actually thought no one of them ever dies is plainly false, as is clear not only from common sense, but from the very description provided by Herodotus. This is further supported even by the slanderous account from the Greeks, who admit the Getae thought Zelmoxis was dead. Third, this argument requires an interpretation that makes no actual sense anyway. If the return of Zelmoxis was thought by the Getae to mean he never died, but only hid away somewhere for 3 years, that would do nothing whatever to persuade them that they or Zelmoxis would never die. Such an event would prove nothing of the sort, and could not have convinced anyone of the plausibility of his promise of immortality. Yet his return, so the hostile account claims, persuaded them that he and they were immortal. Immortal in the specific sense Herodotus describes, which is exactly the same sense in which Christians believe themselves to be immortal, since when they die, their souls go to live with Jesus, just as the Getae's souls go to live with Zelmoxis. Although the Getae might not have believed they would get yet another body later on, unless this Zelmoxis cult was an offshoot of Persian Zoroastrian cult, which did at the time teach such a general resurrection, and the Getae's peculiar monotheism might indicate just such a connection. Other than that, they certainly did believe they would live forever in a real paradise of some kind after the death of their mortal bodies, just as Christians believed would happen to them. Fourth, The slanderous Greek story must have been an attempt to rationalize and explain away something the Gitai really believed, which means it must indicate something genuine about their religion. For example, the claim that a Roman soldier impregnated Mary proves the Christians believed something special about the birth of Jesus, just as the claim that the body was stolen proves there was a belief among some Christians, at the time of that slander, that there was a missing body. So too for the Zalmoxis cult. And here it's not hard to figure out what's the slander and what's the underlying belief targeted by that slander. The idea that Zalmoxis was a common slave and the whole story about his service to Pythagoras and his subsequent avarice and deception is obviously a slander, as is the story about his hiding in a cave. Herodotus himself gives reasons to doubt all of this. Though Herodotus also can't decide if Zalmoxis was ever a real person, this is the natural doubt of a rational Greek historian, who might suspect even the Gaetic account to be a mere myth that they nevertheless believe to be true. And what that was is fairly obvious. They believed their one and only god, Zalmoxis, had visited a group of their ancestors, then died, and then appeared risen from the dead as a proof of his teaching that believers would live eternally with him in paradise. They must also have believed there was a sacred meal attended by the founders of the cult in which drink was shared with their god, sealing a promise that all who drank would receive eternal life. We can be fairly certain of all this because the slanderous account can only be aimed at explaining away these very beliefs. Hence the conspicuous role of drink on a past occasion of importance, with the god actually being present and teaching his disciples, then disappearing and being mourned as dead, and then appearing and proving his defeat of death. Otherwise, if the Gitai didn't believe these things, the Greek story would make no sense, even to Herodotus, since it would not correspond to anything the Gitai actually claimed, and thus would not explain away anything. For example, the Greek story specifically depicts the Gitai believing Zalmoxis died, and then being convinced he was immortal by his subsequent appearance. If the Gitai didn't believe that, then a Greek attempt to explain it with an elaborate story about trickery would be pointless and inexplicable. We must be consistent. Claiming the disciples stole the body is as much a proof of a resurrection belief as claiming Zalmoxis pretended to be dead. Again, none of this entails or implies that Christians borrowed from Zalmoxis' cult the idea of an incarnated, dying, and rising god promising eternal life through a sacred act of drinking at a meal. But it does entail that those elements of Christianity were not new, but had been elements of other cults long before, and possibly still in their day. In other words, there were already pagans who saw nothing wrong with believing their one and only God had come to earth and visited them, died, and appeared risen from the dead. These same pagans also had no trouble believing that sharing in a sacred meal could secure for them and their descendants an eternal life promised by their God. Thus, at least in this respect, Christians were not working against the grain of plausible religious concepts of the time, which is exactly my point. How the pagan mission changed Christianity. It's sometimes claimed that the Jews made a distinction between resurrection and mere resuscitation, even though there is no evidence such a distinction was at all widespread among the Jews. But that makes no difference here. Anyone who would readily believe in the resurrection of a corpse, and we see many pagans did, could easily believe, for example, in the subsequent improvement of that body, rendering it immortal. The Zoroastrians believed this explicitly, and many of the Greeks and Romans did too, in their conception of the divine body of gods and immortal heroes, and what the Christians were selling was essentially the very same thing. Otherwise, there was certainly no major distinction between resurrection and resuscitation in the Greek or Hebrew languages. The same words meant both. For instance, the most distinctive Christian word for resurrection, anistemi, and cognates, was used just as often to refer to ordinary occasions of getting up from sleep or rest, waking up from an apparent death, or the pagan idea of revival of a corpse. Even the Christians themselves used the same word for mere revivification. So there was no distinction in the vocabulary, and the conceptual distinction was hardly commonplace or well-defined even within Judaism. In fact, the general resurrection for some Jews was identical to resuscitation, the only difference being that God would change the laws of the universe so bodies would not die or decay, much as the Zoroastrians believed, whereas other Jews, like Paul, imagined instead that God would change our bodies to produce the same effect, which was no different from what pagans imagined happening to deified heroes. In fact, that the Christian conception of resurrection was essentially the same as the pagan idea of apotheosis in a new divine body is quite clear in Paul, who describes resurrection as rising in a superior, glorious body akin to the bodies of heavenly beings. See 1 Corinthians 15, verses 35 to 54. And then ascending into the sky. See 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 16 to 17. All to rule over angels. See 1 Corinthians 6, verse 3. Which is essentially how the pagans imagined their demigods. I've mentioned before how Holding likes to pretend he knows what he's talking about. A good example right here is his remark that, quote, "While we are aware that the word anistemi was used of resurrection, resuscitation, or even such mundane things as getting up from a seat, the word form anastasis I have yet to see any evidence of being used of anything but what is conceptually Jewish resurrection," end quote. Well, he has not seen any evidence of this because he never bothered to look. Just take a gander at the definition of anastasis in the Liddell and Scott Greek-English lexicon. There you can see how wrong Holding is, for you will find listed every mundane meaning with cited examples. It could mean any ordinary getting up or rising up, even in the Septuagint, Lamentations 3, verse 63. Or it could mean any kind of rising from the dead. Not only does Hebrews 11, verse 35 use it to refer to what Holding would tell you were mere resuscitations in the Old Testament, but we have it this way in pagan texts as well. Aeschylus uses it to refer to the mere revival of a corpse. Lucian uses it to refer to the resurrection of Tyndareus by Asclepius. Plotinus uses it to refer to the soul's resurrection from the body. According to the Thesaurus Linguae Graecae, the word anastasis is used over 30 times in extant pagan literature before the time of Christ. Are we to believe these are all in reference to, quote-unquote, what is conceptually Jewish resurrection? Holding's bluff has been called. There simply was no terminological distinction between kinds of resurrection in antiquity. Once I exposed him on this, Holding desperately rewrote his response. In his new version, he mostly waxed on about irrelevant points, another of his common tactics, to pretend he's arguing for or against something when in fact he's doing neither because he can't, since all the facts and arguments are so plainly against him. But then he also falsely claimed I denied there was any conceptual distinction between kinds of revival. But that must betray his poor memory, or open dishonesty, since I had repeatedly said there was such a distinction in concept, just not in the vocabulary, another example of Holding's inability or refusal to get straight what I say. But even this distinction in concept is irrelevant, since there were pagans aplenty who were ready to believe in either kind of revival. So, contrary to Holding, there was no apparent barrier to conversion here. Indeed, even the New Testament proves this. When Paul preached at Athens, then one of the greatest centers of intellectual life and critical thought in the whole world, his audience reacted in several different ways. They didn't all think what he said was ridiculous. Though some of the Greeks sneered, others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." And a few even became followers of Paul and believed. Just look at Acts 17, verses 30 to 32. That probably represents the true proportion of pagan responses to the entire Christian message. Some sneered, exactly as Holding observes, but some remained curious and considered it, and a few even bought it and believed. Holding then says, we can see well enough that Paul had to fight the Gnostics, the Platonists, and the ascetics on these counts, though it's unclear to me what he means. There is no case anywhere in the epistles or even in Acts where Paul debates with any of these groups by name, nor any example of any of these groups disputing the resurrection of Jesus. Even Paul's opponents at Corinth only denied the resurrection of the converted, not that of Jesus. Paul thus rebuts them by explaining how denying the latter was an unforeseen consequence of denying the former, which means he assumed they all agree Christ was raised. I can only suppose Holding means that Paul must have engaged such debates, even though we have none on record, except general allusions to them, as in Acts 17. That's probably true. At least, Paul must have debated the concept of resurrection with, for example, Platonists in Athens, as well as philosophers of every other stripe. It's less certain if he debated whether Jesus was raised with Christian Gnostics, since most such sects already agreed Jesus had risen. Paul might have debated the details with them, but there's no specific evidence of that, In fact, there's no evidence he wrestled with any Christian groups who actually denied the resurrection of Christ. I suppose that's possible, though explaining how there could be such groups so close to the evidence would raise an interesting conundrum for Holding. But in any event, Holding wrongly assumes that all of Paul's enemies were Gnostics or all ancient philosophers were Platonists. Hence, against the obvious conclusion that many pagans had nothing against the Christian notion of resurrection, Holding declares, quote, "The pagan world was awash with points of view associated with those who thought matter was evil and at the root of all of man's problems," end quote. Such a point of view did exist among a segment of the population, yes, especially among the more snobbish elite. It was indeed the dominant paradigm among Orphic mystics and Platonist philosophers, and a feature of the more popular mystery religions. But we have no evidence of many diehard advocates of these movements flocking to early Christianity. Hence, it appears those were the very people the Christians largely failed to evangelize in their first 100 years. Rather, their success was greatest among the middle and lower classes, among whom this Platonic and Orphic disdain for the flesh is less in evidence. And yet even so, the earliest Christians sought to accommodate even these sensibilities, as we see in Paul's effort to articulate a view of the resurrection that appealed to the Orphic mindset. We will leave the dirty material behind and get bodies made of superior heavenly material instead. However you interpret what Paul was trying to say in these passages, it cannot be denied that what he says would have appealed to the very people Holding has in mind here, because it satisfied their desire to live forever without the stains and burdens of our present bodies. Thus, Christianity could be sold to everyone. As Christianity evolved into numerous competing sects over the later first century, some went even further toward this Orphic disdain for the flesh accommodated by Paul, and we generally call these groups Gnostic, though not always correctly, while others went in the other direction, toward a restoration of the flesh that died, whom I shall call Sarcists, after Sarx or Sarsis, flesh. Concerning this split, Dale Martin demonstrates that early Christian preaching about the resurrection of the dead actually divided the Corinthian church along social status lines. He shows how the elite members, influenced by popular philosophy to deprecate the body, opposed the idea of a resurrected body, while the lower classes more readily accepted early Christian preaching about resurrected bodies. The division arose because Jew and Gentile alike could find analogies to Christian resurrection within their own culture, especially in views apparently held by the masses. But these views were generally ridiculed by the philosophically educated, whereas to the lower classes such a view was perfectly acceptable, such is the argument of Dale Martin. In fact, popular concern to save the flesh is reflected in the popularity of personal and funerary beliefs that obsessed over the relative integrity of the corpse and body. Not everyone regarded corpses as mere offal. Most held the welfare of the corpse to be important to the well-being of the dead, to the point that discarding or mutilating corpses often disturbed people. And that's not the attitude of a Platonist. This didn't mean such people expected to get their bodies back, but it does mean they would not have abhorred the idea of getting their bodies back, especially improved bodies, free of all that was bad about the old ones, which is exactly what the Christians were offering. Caroline Bynum, a leading expert on Western resurrection ideology, argues that, quote, "One cannot say that Christians taught literal, material, fleshly resurrection because Christ rose thus, as there is a full range of interpretation of Jesus' resurrection in the Gospels and Paul," end quote. So the choice made by any particular group still requires explanation. And it appears that one leading motive of the Sarcists was to maintain social hierarchy and control. Bynum demonstrates that Christians who explicitly defended a resurrection of the flesh after the second century argued it was necessary to make sure, for example, that women remained subjugated to men. Jerome, for instance, disgusted by women using a Pauline doctrine to justify haughty declarations of sexual equality, implied that resurrection of the flesh was needed to oppose this, apparently to ensure women remained subjugated to men in the future world. In contrast, Paul envisioned the elimination of all distinctions of class, race, and gender in the end. Even Paul's infamous, though apocryphal, misogyny was based on the inheritance of sin through Adam and Eve, which of course would all be done away with in the new creation. For once their body of Adam died, women would no longer inherit the sin of Eve. This was the original vision of the Christian movement, equality for everyone in a utopian future, against the elite use of class, race, and gender distinctions to oppress the people under the heel of injustice. But after its first 100 years, this vision was hijacked by a sect obsessed with maintaining those very inequalities, even in heaven. Since this development came many generations later, the story of why and how it took place can have nothing to do with what really happened to Jesus on that first Easter day. We cannot be certain whether that was the original motive for a shift away from Paul and toward a more radical Sarcicism in the first 100 years of the church. It appears to have been a factor in its success later on, especially after the 3rd century, when Christianity became a religion of the government. But those first 100 years are inadequately documented to find out what happened or why, which is also a problem for anyone who wants to insist, contrary to the evidence of Paul, that the original church was thoroughly Sarcicist. But from the analysis of Dale Martin and others, and given the evidence of popular beliefs I surveyed earlier, it seems likely that many among the uneducated masses, and even some among the educated class, were disturbed by the idea of losing their body. These groups were apparently not impressed by highbrow attempts to argue for a disembodied immortality. To the contrary, regardless of what they believed, getting their bodies back was more what they wanted, and was easier to understand, defend, and explain. And that made them highly receptive to the idea. Judaism clearly offered it, and early Christianity was unmistakably a Jewish movement. Then an influx of various Jews and pagans who were more attracted to the idea of a resurrection of the flesh, suitably improved and glorified, of course, would have inevitably influenced how some churches came to interpret the resurrection. And once persecution became more widespread in the 2nd and 3rd century, many actual and potential converts who were happier with other modes of salvation might have found easier paths in accepted pagan cults and Jewish sects. This meant persecution may have caused Christianity to swell with those very people who wanted to get their flesh back, since Christianity was the only cult offering that on easy terms. Judaism offered it only on very hard terms, as I explained in Chapter 2. And these people would primarily have come from the most anti-elitist segments of the population, for it was precisely their disdain for the ivory castle argumentation of philosophers that led them to sneer at highbrow concepts of immortality and favor instead the more popular ideas, elevating the dreams and longings of the common man above the fancy rhetoric of the stuffy academics. The effect this had on the development of Christian dogma was probably significant. In the final analysis, when Holden quotes the remark of Feme Perkins that Christianity's pagan critics generally viewed resurrection as misunderstood metempsychosis at best, and at worst it seemed ridiculous, we can agree that does capture the range of attitudes among its critics. But those critics did not represent every view held in antiquity, and by definition, they did not represent Christianity's supporters or converts. It's a simple matter of logic. Those who sympathize will join or tolerate a creed, while those who have opposing ideas will use them to attack that creed. So we cannot claim what those critics say is what the converts believed. To the contrary, it almost certainly is not. That's why they converted. Thus, Holding's arguments do well to explain why some of those who refused to join the movement did not convert. But his arguments tell us nothing about why those who converted actually did so. He can't present a single example of anyone saying, "I used to think resurrection was so impossible as to be ridiculous, but the Christians convinced me otherwise." So Holding's original premise must be restated. Among some pagans, resurrection was deemed impossible. Can we generalize from that to say that all pagans would have resisted the idea? No. Obviously, Epicureans, like Celsus, had strong dogmatic reasons to hold resurrection in contempt. That's why we have no record of any Epicurean being convinced within the first 100 years, and why Celsus tries so hard to argue that resurrection was ridiculous. But Epicureanism was always a minority sect in antiquity, so Holden cannot use the arguments of an Epicurean to represent the entirety of the ancient world. Yes, for Celsus, as he himself said, from the fictional perspective of a skeptical Jew, the question is whether anyone who was really dead ever rose with a veritable body. But neither his Epicurean, nor a Sadducean, nor a Platonic attitude were commonplace among the masses, nor were they universal even among the elite. His own argument attests to this, for Celsus is criticizing Christians for making the same claim of resurrection as many pagans, not a different claim. Again, differences in metaphysical detail are irrelevant here, since no matter the details, it's still the same thing, getting to rise from the dead to live forever in a better body. That's what the Christians, as well as a great many pagans, believed was possible. The bottom line is, as even Origen points out, quote, being an Epicurean, Celsus does not hold the same views with the Greeks, and neither recognizes demons nor worships gods as do the Greeks, end quote. And therefore, his critique of Christianity does not represent the general attitude of the Greeks, or Romans, or Syrians, or anyone else. It represents certain segments of opinion, but a minority only. Similarly, all of N.T. Wright's evidence, to which Holding refers, comes only from a few literary elites who were not representative of the ancient pagan world. Indeed, much of Wright's evidence comes from the wrong period, 4 centuries before the Roman era, and the wrong place, the highly unique culture of classical Athens. In the early Roman Empire, Epicureanism was among the rarest dogmas going. Platonism was more popular, but far more popular still were eclectic varieties of Stoicism and Aristotelianism, and the beliefs among the masses could be described as vulgarized amalgams of all these, with a rich variety of differing opinions. Christians simply won the hearts of those who had sympathetic opinions, hence those who believed it was at least possible to come back to life in a superior body. And the evidence is abundantly clear that there were many who thought so. Jewish background. So much for the mission to the pagans. What about the Jews? Holding claims that among the Jews, quote, there was no perception of the resurrection of an individual before the general resurrection at judgment, end quote. But that's not true. Individual Hebrew and Christian resurrections abound in Scripture. And many Jews had no trouble believing that Jesus might be the resurrected Elijah or John the Baptist. In fact, they expected the resurrection, or at least return, of Elijah to presage the general resurrection of Israel. This is clear from the following conversation recorded in the Gospel of Matthew. Quote, Jesus commanded them, saying, report this vision to no one until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. And his disciples asked him, saying, why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And he answered and said, Elijah did come and shall restore all things. Indeed, I say to you that Elijah has already arrived, and they knew him not, but did to him whatever they wanted. In such a way shall the Son of Man also suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood he was talking about John the Baptist. End quote. In other words, Jesus says he will rise from the dead, prompting his disciples to ask him, if that's the case, why Elijah hasn't returned from the dead, or from heaven, where the dead go. Since he is supposed to come first, Jesus responds by saying Elijah already did come, and that meant John the Baptist was the risen Elijah, and so the disciples infer. Thus, it must have been a common belief that there would be an individual return to the land of the living before the end, similar to Christ's, in whom resided the Spirit of God rather than, in the case of John, the Spirit of Elijah. We see this also when King Herod heard of the miracles performed by Jesus and his disciples, at which, quote, he said, John the Baptizer is risen from the dead, and that's why these powers work in him, end quote. While, quote, others said it is Elijah, or one of the prophets of old, end quote. Now, the prophets of old certainly died and were buried, even if Elijah wasn't. Herod, when he heard these things, said, John, whom I beheaded, he is risen. We even hear that others besides Herod also believed Jesus was the resurrected John. Does that sound like there was no perception of the resurrection of an individual before the general resurrection? To the contrary, it sounds like Jews were ready to believe in just such a thing. Other sources confirm there were many Jews, even within the rabbinic tradition, who expected the resurrection to take place in stages, not all at once. There were many different opinions as to how many stages and in what order they would rise, but in one scheme, there would be 4 stages. First Adam, then